Hello there, this is Gary Parrish from CBS Sports, and this, of course, is the Eye on College Basketball podcast. It's nice to be back. I got Matt Norlander here with me. I got Sam Vecenie with me, and we're going to talk about college hoops in just a moment, I promise. But first, if you'll bear with me, I just want to take a minute and tell everybody how much I appreciate the kind messages my wife and I have received over the past week. I imagine if you're, you know, listening to this podcast that you probably listened to the last podcast, or you probably follow me on Twitter or Facebook or somewhere, which means you likely know the deal. But if not, here's the deal. My wife Kelly and I were expecting our third son here in the next few months. Matt and Sam and I had actually talked about it on this podcast before. The pregnancy was going perfectly. We had been on a baby moon. There were no issues. But early last week, she, you know, just didn't feel right. So she went to the doctor and asked for an ultrasound, and there was no heartbeat. They knew immediately, and I guess because that's the type of thing you know immediately. And you know, meantime, I was in New York. I was actually doing a radio segment at that time, and so I knew she was going to the doctor, but I didn't think anything of it. You know, it was just like whatever. So I finished that segment, and I looked at my phone, and I had like 9 missed calls, and at that point, I knew. You know, right? You're hoping you're mm-hmm. wrong. But when I returned the call frantically, I knew what was coming, or at least I thought I knew what was coming. Her best friend, who was with her at the time, answered the phone, because Kelly was crying too hard to answer the phone. She told me the news that our baby, just a few months from his due date, was, not alive, but, Kelly would still have to deliver him, and that they were transporting her to the hospital immediately. It's just a nightmare, right? In the meantime, like I said, I'm in New York City as opposed to Memphis, Tennessee, where she is. So with the help of the folks at CBS Sports, I got put on a flight home from LaGuardia to Memphis International immediately, landed, went straight to the hospital, and we went to sleep that night knowing we'd wake up Wednesday morning and deliver our stillborn son, which is exactly what we did. I'll spare you the details, but like I wrote on a Facebook post, it's just as awful as you'd imagine. We brought him into this world. We named him Elliot Theodore Parrish. He had 2 hands and 2 feet and 10 fingers and 10 toes, but he did not have a heartbeat. The result of what appears to be an extremely rare umbilical cord issue. It's not something that happens often. We were told basically that 1 out of every 200 pregnancies that goes past 20 weeks become stillborn babies, right? So it's pretty rare. And then of that 1 out of every 200, only about 2% of those are the result of an umbilical cord issue. So you do the math. Like I said, it's a very, very rare thing, and it's also unpredictable and also unpreventable, but it does happen, and it happened here, and the result was our little boy being delivered without a heartbeat last Wednesday morning. So we held him for a little while, and then we handed him over, and you know, we left the hospital Thursday afternoon, and he stayed there. And then we went to the funeral home on Friday to finalize arrangements, and he's still there right now. And I cannot tell you how weird and wrong it feels to, you know, go to a hospital and deliver a baby and not leave that hospital with that baby. It's just the worst ride home you can imagine. Just the absolute worst. And needless to say, I never expected when we were doing this podcast this time last week that I'd end the week in a funeral home, right? Making arrangements for our baby. It's just a terrible, terrible deal. But the incredible and overwhelming support we've received from friends and family and even strangers has been so helpful and inspiring. I want to say a special thank you to and I've been surprised by this, the men and women who have been kind enough to open up, men and women who have literally been through this exact same situation and openly shared their stories with me and offered advice, including our colleague at CBS Sports, Kyle Porter, who went through this same deal recently and handled it with such grace and bravery. When I heard his story last month, you know, I sent him a note, basically just told him all the things people are now telling me. And never expected I'd be in the same boat, but I am now. And he offered some great, just really helpful advice last week. And man, he's just a really good dude, just a a really good dude. And folks in the industry have reached out, and coaches and athletic directors and players have reached out. Readers and listeners have reached out. It's been really, really nice. And to all of you, I guess what I just wanted to say was thanks a million. I owe you. I think we both owe you. Kelly and I, but my entire family. The notes and messages we've received have, they've all been incredibly kind, and they're all encouraging. And some try to offer an explanation, and I can appreciate that. In fact, I do appreciate that. But I guess the other thing I wanted to say is that, you know, honestly, I've always sort of subscribed to the idea that life is pretty random. You know, sometimes good things happen to good people, and that's awesome. And sometimes good things happen to bad people, and that's curious. And sometimes bad things happen to good people, and I don't know if it's infuriating, but it can be. And sometimes bad things happen to bad people, and that's at least understandable, like in the spirit of karma, I guess. And either way, like, the whole thing just has always sort of felt mostly random to me. Like, and I don't know, perhaps this is a poor analogy, but like, if you can think of it, for you gamblers out there, like big, you know, big roulette wheels, like two big roulette wheels, right? Like one positive wheel and one negative wheel. And we all have numbers on those wheels, right? And there's a marble for each wheel, and you know, it's spinning, but odds are that marble isn't going to land on your number. So like, odds are you're not going to, you know, from the positive side, you're like, odds are you're not going to win the lottery, right? And from the negative side, like, odds are you're not going to have a kid with cancer. Your life is probably mostly going to stay within the margins. In my life, before last week, had mostly stayed within the margins. But that marble has to land somewhere, and that marble always lands somewhere. And a few weeks back, it landed on Monty Williams, and that's just the saddest story ever. Last week it landed on us. This week it's going to be somebody else, and my thoughts will be with them. But I guess my point is that you know, millions and millions of people deal with tragedies, and there's often no rhyme or reason to it. We're not alone in that regard. We're just joining like an incredibly unfortunate club, but we're going to get through it. And honest to God, you, some of whom are, like I said, complete strangers, you guys are currently helping us get through it. So again, I just wanted to say thank you. I don't necessarily believe this happened for a reason. People tell me that, you know, that this, you know, everything happens for a reason. And I respect that, but I don't know that I subscribe to that. But I do believe that some good can come out of it. And I think my family being exposed to so much generosity feels like maybe that's some good that's coming out of this. I'll be honest, I had this moment over the past few days where I wondered if I've ever been as kind to anybody as folks have been to us over the past week. It probably doesn't speak well of me, but it's eye-opening, right? So perhaps it'll be that'll be the good, right? I'll be a better husband and a better father and a better friend for having gone through this. Or, you know, perhaps I'm reaching. Either way, that's not the point. The point is that this past week has been the worst week ever. But it's also shown me the amazing kindness of people in general. And it's reminded me also of the great people I work for and with. Like my bosses at CBSSports.com. You know, everybody from Anthony Mormon, Jeff Cotula, to Eric Kay, Marcus Nelson, they've been unbelievable, just so understanding and patient. My bosses at CBS Sports Network, you know, people like Dan Weinberg and Ross Molloy and Tyler Hale and Ben Stauber, they've been amazing, and I'll never be able to thank them enough for excusing me from work and putting me on a plane back home literally within minutes of me getting this bad news last Tuesday. My bosses at 92.9 FM in Memphis, Dan Barron and Brad Carson, have been incredible in all of the ways that you need bosses to be incredible during times like these. They all went out of their way to tell me, you know, that I could take as much time as I need, take as much time as my family needs. And I genuinely, like, think I could have told them I'm taking a month off, and they would have all been cool with that. And I appreciate it. But the truth is I want to work, because work is normal, and I want to feel as normal as possible as soon as possible. So I'm not telling you I feel great or that everything's fine. I don't, and it's not. But what I am telling you is that I'm going to try to push toward that, and I think getting back to work is a big part of that. So bottom line, thank you to everybody who's taken the time to type a note or you know, say a prayer. It means the world to me. It really has meant the world to me and my family. And thank you also to you guys sitting quietly, Matt and Sam, but also Chip Patterson for covering for me for the past week. You're great friends and colleagues. I don't know that I deserve you, but I'm glad I have you. And shout out to Devin Downey, and let's get on with it. Did Isaac Humphries deserve that technical foul Saturday night at Texas A&M or what? Seemed questionable to me, New Orleans.
You are not. Yeah. Real quick. Hold on. He's not segueing right now.
Questionable to me, okay,
you have. We're going to do it real quick. Sam and I get a moment here because I know we've said plenty and we could have said so much more on Friday's podcast, but it is great to be talking with you again. Listen, you've definitely shown plenty of instances. I would say, and actually, you know what? I kind of like that we had this kind of conversation because one of the real bummers about dying, and I hope we are all just decades away from dying, is people only say the really good stuff when you can't hear it. And even though you've gone through a tragedy here, GP, through you and your wife, and have heard from so many people, you've done so many really good and kind things in your life. You just have a very unselfish and quiet way about doing it, and it's something that's certainly admirable. But yeah, you've been on our minds constantly. We're glad that we're having this podcast with you back on it for sure. Shout out to Chip Patterson, no doubt. I'm glad that you worked on a shout out to Devin Downey. Let's just do that on every podcast for the rest of the season. Let's just make that a thing.
I think that
But no, listen, like, you've definitely been our thoughts. It kind of speaks to your character. I've never seen, and you know, Facebook's only one kind of thing, but I've never seen, I've had friends, you know, have children and announce marriages and post, you know, amazing photos from across the world and heartbreaking news. I have never seen someone receive more engagement and response and reaction on anything they've ever posted on Facebook than what I saw in terms of your response. And that's just on your Facebook page. Right. So it speaks to obviously the gravity of the tragedy, but to you as a person and you and Kelly as a couple. She's continually in our thoughts, and yeah, I'm going to give Sam the floor here real quick as well, but you know, we're so happy to have you back, and this is not easy, and it's, you know, we're heading toward really the most critical time of the season, but I get what you're saying, just because, you know, in times like these, you want to have things to occupy the mind, and college basketball within the scope of this tragedy is obviously a very trivial thing, but at the same time, it's something that's, you know, so rewarding for us, and something we love and we love to follow and we love to debate about. And I can't wait to get into talking about Wisconsin basketball, but those kind of things can be sure. Good. So you don't have to kind of sit around and stew, but we definitely would have given you as much time as you wanted, but we're glad to have you back. Go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, hopefully work and basketball and everything can at least give you some sort of time away from everything you're dealing with. And I mean, you've clearly been in my thoughts, you've been in Matt's, you've been in Chip's, you've been in everyone's, clearly all across the internet. And that speaks to you, your character, and your family. And it just really is awful what happened to you. And we just hope that you can find a way through it. And I think that you said it best, that hopefully you can look on the positive side of this and come out a better person for it. And I'm sure that you will. And I mean, you've been just so incredible to me since I've come from a totally different thing and dealing with all of the stupid stuff that I ask you daily. So I can't ask for a better colleague. I can't ask for a better friend. And like I said, you've been in my thoughts all week, and hopefully everything can continue to move forward.
I can whip out the guitar and start playing a ballad if you really want. You really want to turn this into something really campfire style.
Yeah, I will tell you the interesting. There's been a million interesting things about this, or strange things, or sad things. But like, you know, people try so hard to like. First off, I've just been blown away by the sheer number of notes I've received. Like, you know, when I sat down, I guess it was. I don't know. I guess last Wednesday night, maybe it was probably Wednesday night, and just started typing into my computer because I knew I had to say something. Like, you know, I'm not a private person, and I don't keep my personal life private. I won't tell you there aren't things about me that people don't know. I mean, I don't share every up and down and peak and valley of my personal life, of which there have been plenty, but you know, if you listen to my radio show, if you listen to this podcast, if you follow me on Twitter, like, you know Kelly, you know, probably know Aiden and Oliver, like, you know my family, we've been on a baby moon. Like, this wasn't something that I could not talk about publicly or address publicly, I didn't think. Because at some point, like, people just wonder, yo, where's your kid? I thought you had another kid on the way, right? Mm-hmm. And so I knew I was something I was going to have to address, and I didn't. I might have overshared a little bit, but I don't know. I was really humbled by how that seemed to resonate with people, and the amount of response I got was just overwhelming. Like, I haven't worked for a few days, but I bet you I've typed 500,000 words because I tried to get back to as many people as I could. And let me be clear, if I haven't returned a message from you, God, it's only because I'm confused. I might have missed something somewhere. If so, it's unintentional. But I can't tell you how many notes I got from people who, and I think I mentioned this earlier, have been through literally the same thing, right? Like they umbilical cord, 35 weeks, whatever it was. Like, they've been through something, if not the exact same thing, very similar. And, it helps. I think maybe like what I wrote and the way I wrote it helped them because they realized, wow, I felt all those same things too. The simple things from, and Matt, you'll remember this because you were just in the hospital, having your little boy. Like, it is so weird to be there and you're surrounded by people who have just experienced.
Like, you see them in the hallways. Like, you're like, you might not know their name, but you like, you see them on like an every 4 to 6 hour basis because they just had the child around you. You don't have the same experience.
Oh, God.
I get where you're coming from with this.
Yeah, yes. No, you see, not only that, you like go down to get a cup of coffee and you see their brother and sister bringing balloons in, you see all of this. And, it's just such a weird contrast. And, because these people, and keep in mind, let me be clear, like Kelly and I we've had that experience twice, like we've been through the greatness of childbirth and of welcoming a little boy into the world. And but suddenly you're the only person there that's not full of joy. Like if you're in room 403, room 404 is a couple that have just experienced the most amazing, beautiful thing. And in room 402 to your right, same thing. And you're stuck in the middle. And not only do you hear them laughing and their family laughing, and I don't blame them. Like, I would be, I've been there. Like, I'm not, but like, you hear it and you hear their baby crying in the middle of the night and your baby's not, it's just like, ugh. Like, it, and even, I don't want to say making it worse, but like, 'cause it wasn't making it worse. But like, one of our friends, she was pregnant. She was someone who posted on, our Instagram pages and we'd post on her Instagram pages and she and Kelly would both, I think I finally reached the point where I'm oversharing, but I'll finish the story at least. But they would oh, look, here's 4 months. Here's, look at my baby bump. It was like that kind of thing. And, mm-hmm. But she was much further along than Kelly. And so, our children were delivered within 30 minutes of each other. Same hospital the other day.
Well,
yeah. And they're like, so she's posting on Instagram. So we follow each other on Instagram and she's posting on Instagram, the baby's here. And like, I was like, oh God, like we really just had our babies delivered within 30 minutes of each other, obviously under incredibly different circumstances. And then I do want to say this, and not to name drop or whatever, but I thought it was just the sweetest thing. Last Wednesday, Scott Van Pelt had a boy.
And I picked up on this after, yeah.
He sent me the absolute sweetest note, and then sent a follow up the next day just to check in. And like, in this moment where I think I'm not telling you a secret about Scott. There's a reason why he's among the most likable TV like big stars. Not everybody who's a big star on television is well liked. You can pick out who's who. I don't need to be involved in that conversation, but just trust me when I tell you not every so-called big time television star is well liked. But I think basically everybody likes Scott. I think that I don't know any. Let me put it this way: I don't know anybody who doesn't. And I just thought it spoke really well of him in this amazing moment for him and his family. Like, he just had his little boy and he named him after his father. And my God, what's more beautiful than that? Like, he took a moment. A couple moments out of his days to like send like really nice, thoughtful messages, that meant the world to me. But like, I guess the point was, you can't escape all that. Like, you really I had a very close personal friend, and then Scott, of course, also have these amazing experiences literally on the same day, that we were going through what we were going through. I don't know. It's just, it's hard to, it's a rough deal. I guess that's what I was trying to say. It's a really.
This was good though. This was therapeutic. I'm glad we talked it
I know.
Out.
I appreciate it. Just bill me. Tell me what I owe you.
No. It's good. It's a like it is a it has been a depressing college basketball season in a lot of ways. Yeah. Like there's just been way too much. And that, death around the season.
Well, I mean, there's Andrew, yeah, so, the Andrew Smith story. And listen, everybody's going through their, you know, everybody's got stuff going. Not everybody has stuff like this going on, but like lots of people are, you know, are going through things. And sometimes they're as bad as this. And so I recognize there's nothing really anything that unique about our story, but it's a mess. And I guess the other thing, and then I promise we'll move on. Like, as I get ready to go back to work, you know, it's not like I don't have a normal job. Like I just like, you know, I don't work in a cubicle and like, you know, do paperwork. Like I'm, my jobs are very public jobs. Like my voice will be on radio, you know, like, and you sort of struggle with, how do you laugh? You know, like how do you make jokes? Like, what do you like? I even thought about it like from the poll attacks, like the poll attacks is like centered and is rooted in me, like being cocky and telling you how stupid you are. Well, how can I tell other people? Like these people have been like, and like after having like thousands of people be so incredibly kind to me and my family, how do I just pop right back in and tell somebody?
There's
going to
be some jerk who didn't reach out and who ranked Oregon 8th.
Yeah.
You're going to go after him.
Yeah. If you're the asshole who didn't send me a nice note and you got an AP vote with something a little questionable on it, you're getting yours Monday night.
Now's the time.
Yeah. But, no, sure. Like among the things that went through my head was like, how do I write the poll attacks? Cause that's like, it sort of comes off as jerky, right? Like it's a little bit of
Here's my thing. If anything, you've got more, a longer leash than you've ever had.
Yeah,
seriously.
No, it'll probably be the most passive poll attacks ever when I file that on Monday afternoon, Monday night. But anyway, I was serious about this Isaac Humphries thing.
Sure.
Did he deserve that technical foul? I was watching. I was like, come on, man. You swallow your whistle there, right?
I'll let Sam take it. My short take is I understand the letter of the law, but I even think here it was the wrong call.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it was the right call. Pat Adams has thrown himself into quite a few sticky situations in the SEC this season. This was just the latest in a long line. If you remember that, I want to say it was Arkansas, Texas A&M game that had like so many foul calls. It was it might have been the Anthony Collins game even. Is that right? Maybe that was Alabama. No, it was a game before that. But it was not the right call, like not the right situation. Why are you not letting these kids decide this game? It was absurd to me.
Because he really did like decide the game. That call decided the game.
Yeah. He 100% decided the game. Yeah. They went down, knocked down both free throws, if I'm remembering correctly. I'm pretty sure they knocked down both. Yeah. And that was
Yes, they did. And then the
Scal,
weird situation.
And then Scal, right. Scal made one, missed one.
Who had not been in most of the game. Scal went one for two, which then set up the, yes, but yeah.
Yeah, no, and but seriously, it decided the game. That was the, you know, that was how it was decided. And there's no way that you can decide a basketball game when an 18-year-old kid like doesn't even spike the ball. Like, and he wasn't even doing it to show up an opponent. That's the key here. Like,
he wasn't doing it to show up an opponent or to show up the official. He was he was just happy. Like, why are we mad at a kid for being like this kid who we didn't even know he's going to be in school this year. And suddenly he's in school this year and he's on national television and he just like, you know, a defensive play sort of just decided the game and he's just happy. Like the idea that you could take this unbelievable moment from this kid's college career to date and turn it into a nightmare. Just like, what is wrong? Like, why would you do that?
Yeah. And he might be the youngest player in college basketball this year.
Right.
If he's not the youngest, he is really close.
And I want to just point out that after the game, Cal has been really good. Like, I was at the Kansas game when Kentucky lost. Cal was really good in the post game. And then he was really good after this one. And not only that, but Ulis spoke in the presser, and he told the media that Humphries basically was apologizing to every single person in the locker room, which he has no need to do. Right. But it speaks to Humphries' character, especially, you know, the age, the situation, and all that, that he, like, felt, like, real serious guilt over this, which is natural. But unnecessary. The end of that game, by the way, listen, a nice win for A&M, it's going to really help its profile, and this will end up dinging. I don't think if Kentucky ran the table, I still think they'd get a 4 at best. UK is going to be in a weird situation with its seeding. This one was kind of costly. The game was just weird. Like, it took forever. There were reviews, like the final minutes of regulation, then overtime. Like, it took like 35 minutes. It was really one of the longest just games to play out. So kind of a weird one. And then the SEC just got a little more clogged. If Kentucky had won, it's probably still going to win the SEC, but that would have like decided it essentially. And right. Since they lost, it's a little more.
I'll tell you who's going to be a weird spot with Kentucky seeding is everybody else in their region.
Okay, yeah, I know.
I mean, can you imagine? Like, they're going to be a 4-5 seed.
I'm going to guess 5. Okay. If I'm guessing, I'll say a 5.
Okay, let's say
I'm going to say 3 or 4.
Okay. Let's say they're a 4. All right, let's split the difference. We'll say that they've got some bad losses on their resume. I think they're one of the best, probably 10 teams in America, but they don't have a top 10 resume, anything close to it. Like, just trust me in the sense that I look at these things every day. I think they're one. And this is where, to the extent Kentucky fans like and I disagree on it, which like we do. They say, hey, you really don't think Kentucky – and I get it. You can rank teams based on just who you think's better, just disregard the records and say, I think this team's great. I'm ranking them 4th. But I tend to like sort of I respect the resume. That's sort of my saying. I respect the resume. Whatever the resume says you are, that's what you are. Their resume is not that good. But I do think they're really good. And so they're going to be, let's just say, a 4 seed. And you imagine you're, Villanova. And you've had this amazing season and you get a 1 seed. And now you look up in the Sweet 16, and you go, we're outmanned.
Yeah.
And that's what's going to happen. They're going to do that to somebody, and there's a chance, Duke could maybe do that to somebody.
The funnier one is going to be if Villanova ends up with, like, Cal is their 8 seed, right, and then Kentucky is their 4.
Right.
Because that's going to happen to someone this year. Someone's going to get hit with, like, a double whammy like that.
Right.
Where you have some ridiculous 8 seed like Cal, and you have some ridiculous 4-5 seed like Kentucky.
You know what? But, like, I remember a few years ago, I don't remember exactly what year it was, but it was the year Andre Drummond was at Connecticut, so whatever year that was. But I remember we kept talking about that Connecticut, I did at least, talking about that Connecticut team, like, man, you don't want any part of them because, yeah, they've struggled and they've been up and down and inconsistent all year long, but you look at that roster and they can get you. And then they were at 8 seed and we were like, woo-wee. I think it might have been Kentucky's national championship team. I think it might have been the Anthony Davis team. Did Davis and Drummond come out the same year?
I think that Connecticut team played Royce White's.
Yes. That is right, because it was. It was like, and everybody picked Connecticut to beat Iowa State. It was the Royce White team. And it was like, ooh, then you get Connecticut to Kentucky, and Connecticut's got pros and blah, blah, blah. And then it was like, you know what? They just went out and did what they did all year, played like nothing and lost in the round of 64. Yep. And so, like, I'm not predicting that for Cal or Kentucky or any of these super talented teams, but sometimes teams just are what they are. On the other hand, 2014, that Kentucky team turned it on. You know, they did what I think some people think this Kentucky team can do, which is just flip a switch and go. But they're obviously good enough to do it. I don't want to be in their region. If I'm a 1 seed, 2 seed, 3 seed, like, I don't want any part of that, but obviously somebody's going to get a part of that. Meantime, you mentioned Kansas because you were at that game a few weeks ago in Orlando, the Kansas-Kentucky game. Look up. Guess who's got a 2-game lead in the Big 12 standings with only 4 games left? And how about this? So two of the games, two of the 4 remaining games for Kansas, they're at Allen Fieldhouse. So unless Kansas loses at Allen Fieldhouse, which, as Norlander detailed recently, just does not happen, it's going to be 12 straight Big 12 titles. Like, it's just unbelievable. Like, we spent all season going, well, what about this? And what about this? And what about, you know, if this happens, then, and then, like, it's February 21st, and they've got a 2-game lead in the Big 12 standings. Mm-hmm. Like, that, they're not only going to win it, they might win it by multiple games.
They're going to win it by multiple games, and I think ESPN flashed a graphic. I was, like, doing a bunch of stuff when it happened, but this will now be the second longest ever, because Gonzaga once went 11 straight years doing what Kansas has done, and then it ended. I think UCLA did 14 straight Pac-8 titles, so that's the only one that still has to be conquered by Bill Self, and I mean, honestly, it might happen. Kansas is now – what's happened here is Kansas and Villanova – there were 5 top 10 teams that went down this week. Oklahoma lost, Iowa lost, UNC lost, Maryland lost at Minnesota. We covered that in detail on Friday's podcast, and Maryland kind of got out against Michigan State against Michigan on Sunday. That was not inspiring whatsoever. And West Virginia also lost. But with Kansas and Nova, in my opinion, they have now really started to establish how they're going to be clear-cut ones. This was my suspicion a couple weeks ago, because we had discussed how if it was going to be a total mix-up and heading in ones, twos, threes, and fours, how much difference there would be. I felt there might be one or two teams that would create some separation. Now, don't get me wrong, Kansas can still lose. Maybe it gets really freaking weird and drops in the quarterfinals of the Big 12 tournament. I think even if that happened, it's going to be a one seed. In my opinion, what Villanova and Kansas have done has created a situation where they're almost like, unless they absolutely cave in, they're going to be the ones. And what I think we could have happen is if it broke just perfectly, and I don't know if this has ever happened, two conferences be responsible for all of the onesies. I bet it has. I just don't remember. And maybe it happened like within.
Well, there was 1 year where the one seeds, and I only remember this because where I grew up, but I want to say the ones were, no. That was the four, the final four. It was three.
The final four was 08. Yeah. 08's the famous year. Where
I know. But I mean that in 85, the final four was three Big East teams.
Three Big East teams. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And that was
I don't know if it was ones. I don't know if it was, I don't remember the last. We certainly had two ones come from the same league. I don't know about three ones come from the same league.
I feel like three ones from the same league has happened once before. The beauty of the podcast, these kind of things just pop up.
I didn't. Three ones doesn't really have a shot to happen this year either.
No, it doesn't. But what I'm getting at is, so Xavier plays, and I'm kind of rambling from GP's Kansas thing, but Kansas is, in my opinion, like he's the clear-cut, it has the best resume. It's on pace to be the number one overall seed. But we have a good game with Nova at Xavier on Wednesday. And in my opinion, if Xavier wins that game and then those both teams don't lose again until they meet in the title game of the Big East, I think actually both Xavier and Villanova will have very, very strong cases to be number ones. Just like if Oklahoma, even though Kansas wins the Big 12 regular season, if Oklahoma basically doesn't lose again and wins the Big 12 tournament title, it's going to have a really super strong case for a number one seed. Obviously, a lot of things have to break that way, but we could be pushing toward that where those four teams could be the ones. Michigan State's still there as well, but it's now developing into something interesting there.
Here's what I would tell you, and I don't disagree. I think it's possible, but you know who Xavier's best win is?
Yeah, I'm not seeing it for them.
They haven't beat anybody.
I know.
Their best win is what? USC, maybe?
Dayton? USC?
Dayton neutral, USC, and then...
I mean, they won at Providence.
Providence would register, and at Butler would register as tougher wins because those are road wins.
Michigan, in terms of the quality of teams. At Michigan.
But a Nova win would jump it up, and they in their RPI, then would also
jump.
No,
the RPI is fine. I guess my point is they don't have very many... They've got, I'm looking at it now, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 top 50 wins. That's not bad. But, like, in terms of, like, the marquee signature victories, they're kind of missing that at this point. Like,
zero top 25 Ken Palm.
Well, how about this? Dayton could fall out of the top 25 on Monday when the polls are released.
Yes.
Southern Cal's not in or
they're not going to.
Okay.
They went. Yeah, they've kind of bottomed out.
By Monday afternoon, Xavier's resume could feature zero wins over top 25 teams in the AP poll. In fact, I think it will. Is that one seed?
Let me bring it up real quick. I still like because listen, I'm basing some of this off of Palm Adam as a one like 2 weeks ago, before the Creighton loss. So I listen, and again, I would if we were using other metrics aside from just pure RPI, sure. I'm with you. But I have a sense that if it were to beat Nova and then not lose again, if it never lost until we got Selection Sunday, I think it would unequivocally end up being a one seed just because there's been so much
structure. And they might. I mean, if they never lost again until Selection Sunday, they'd be sitting at 25, 26, 27. Probably they'd finish 30-3 with two wins over Villanova.
They're sixth in the RPI right now. And their strength of schedule overall is second, or their league strength of schedule overall. And their strength of schedule is 11-12-0 against the top, against non-conference. I get what you're saying, and I'm not even saying they should be one. In fact, I would argue maybe it's better that they don't get a one, just in terms of because like I don't know. Sometimes I wonder if those teams that like that was not on them to be a one seed this year, and sometimes that can come really hot and heavy for these teams, and I wonder if sometimes the pressure of that can get to them. So they might be better served as a two, especially if what we're talking about, you'd rather get maybe a softer seven seed than an eight like a Cal or whoever might fall into that range. I get you, but overall Kansas and Nova is my primary point that I took time to get to. Like those teams have really, they aren't taking bad losses, really.
Yeah.
And they should be one seeds barring absolute cave-ins.
I would think so. Go back.
There's one thing that I kind of wanted to talk about with you guys to see if you buy this. We're kind of talking about like all this, their RPI would be really high. How do we know for sure that the RPI is that valuable anymore?
Here's what's that valuable.
I don't know that we do, by the way.
Here's how I know it's valuable. It's undeniably valuable. I hate it, but here's
the fact. No. It's not that it's not valuable. I think it's valuable. I think that its value is diminishing, though.
It might be diminishing, but it still by far permeates the room because they use the team sheets,
and all of
the data on the team sheets, strength of schedule, top 25 wins, top 50 wins. All of that stuff is based on the RPI. It's not based on any other metric. It's not based on RPI combined with Sagarin, combined with Massey, combined with KenPom. It's all RPI based. So when they look at these team sheets and they say, okay, let's bring up team A versus team B or A versus B versus C, it's all based on metrics within the RPI. Right. So within that, yes, it does have significance and still too much influence.
Here's what it definitely has
significance. Don't get me wrong. Go ahead.
Here's what I've always said. Your RPI doesn't matter. I mean, it all matters. So, like, let me rephrase. Your RPI doesn't matter nearly. Here's what I would say about Xavier. Xavier's RPI doesn't matter nearly as much as Providence's RPI matters to Xavier. In other words, they've got two wins over Providence right now. If Providence is in the top 25 of the RPI on that team sheet, it shows up as two top 25 wins. If it's top 50, it shows up as two top 50 wins. If Providence slips out of the top 50, then it shows up as two sub 50 wins. Like, I've always believed that your RPI, whether it's 6 or 11 or 3 or whatever, is less important than what it looks like on that team sheet, like what your wins and losses look like. And so the RPI is incredibly important. How about this? When I rank teams every morning, I can look right now and tell you what Xavier's RPI is. I just looked a second ago. I didn't know before that. But I knew how many top 25 wins it had and top 50 wins. I pay more attention to what your body of work says related to the RPI as opposed to what your actual RPI is. In other words, the RPI thinks that it's a grouping tool more than it's a ranking tool, if that makes sense.
No, I think that that's fair. But I think that a lot of people still think of the RPI as a lot of the be-all, end-all, so to speak, of the way that teams are selected for the NCAA tournament. And I think that that's changing. I mean, last year, Scott Barnes, who was the committee chair, even came out and said, hey, we spent more time in the room looking at, KenPom or Sagarin or, what's the ESPN one? Stuff like that.
I have pushed for this. When I did the mock selection, it was Gassaway, Nate Silver, and I basically spent an hour filibustering, and everyone else I think hated us because we were like, you need to stop using the RPI. You need to start realizing there are so many better metrics that you can use, and if you want to still include it, have it be one of many. I think that the NCAA selection committee and David Warlock, who was in the room and helps, and Shaheen, who did it for so long, they understand. That other metrics need to be taken into account. And I bet, and I have zero doubt that the KenPom page is brought up and someone has a subscription, without a doubt. But the fact of the matter is they are still using the team sheets when it comes down to the debates. And when you're using the team sheets that is based in an RPI DNA, those are having the most predominant influence over these teams. Sure. I think that
predominant is fair. I think that it's decreasing in predominance, though.
That's fair. I don't think that's inaccurate.
I would
say
it's fragile, and I would agree, and I hope that within 5 years to 10 years, we're no longer using team sheets based on RPI, because the only thing, in my opinion, that the RPI is good for, and I don't like it, but the one thing that it does is if you schedule crappily, okay, if you line up with cupcakes, your number will be killed for it. Now, again, this goes to what GP said. GP said it's not really more about your number, but what your team sheet and your overall picture suggests. And so if you try and get by like, say, a Pittsburgh does, the RPI will out you and it will not give you a good chance, which should have, big boy schools, they should be pressured into scheduling with challenging outside of conference, because otherwise – it's this weird balance between how good you are versus how good your schedule is, because otherwise everyone would schedule crap teams and say, no, we're awesome. Judge us on how good we are. No, you have to test yourself, because that's got to be a little of both.
I think that the team that's being hurt by that is, and we can kind of transition to this team now, is LSU. I mean, LSU, I think, is 88 or 89 in the RPI now. after losing this weekend, and they obviously kind of stink at this point. There's not really another way to put it. But so many teams are going to clamor, or so many people are going to clamor for them to be in, when the resume and their strength of schedule and everything is clearly going to say that they should not be in the tournament.
Here's the thing, like I because I see this all the time, like on social media, and I guess on television some, like, it's like it feels like a storyline is whether Ben Simmons is going to be in the NCAA. Do we like really care if Ben Simmons is in the tournament that much? Like, I don't.
I mean, I'm writing about this for Wednesday.
Okay.
I've about hit a breaking point with this.
Yeah, I'm like, listen, I like, if Ben Simmons is playing on TV in the NCAA tournament, I'll watch it. But like, if he's not, what do I like? It won't move the needle even a second. Because let's be honest, even if Ben Simmons is in the tournament, he's in the tournament for 40 minutes. You know what I'm saying?
And without a doubt, and Sam, I wonder how many people are clamoring for it, like for in terms of LSU. I get what you're saying.
No, I don't think that there are people that actually watch college basketball throughout the season that clamor for it. I think that it's the people who watch the NCAA tournament that will clamor for it.
And like, yeah, absolutely. Listen, LSU is just a disaster. I mean, it had a brutal week last week. They can still get to the tournament, but now they've got this random slippery game at Arkansas, and Simmons looked bad. I mean, we kind of name drop Gavoni, Jonathan Gavoni, who runs Draft Express and does a great job, like on an every other week basis. But he basically killed Simmons.
Never
looked worse than what he saw. He was disinterested. There's an academic matter. There was this one play where he airballed like this twisting runner, and then Armani Moore was kind of already falling to the ground, but Simmons definitely like nudged him. Like it was a frustrating like push kind of thing. Like it was a weird, super weird game. And so you just wonder, like, you know, this is truly cliche alert, but it's like gut check time. Like they have to win at least three more games, probably four, to feel safe. That includes the NCAA or the SEC tournament in order to get to the NCAA tournament. But Sam's greater point with the RPI is right. I mean, no team worse than a 74, and that was New Mexico State in 99 before teams started to kind of game the RPI has ever gotten in. Really, if you're an at-large team or a candidate from a major conference and you're not basically 60 or better, generally I think that you don't stand a chance, even though I know that's not a rule. I'm just saying your schedule will line up in such a way and your results would be like, if you're worse than 60 in the modern era, I just don't think you have really any chance of getting out.
And LSU's got three top 50 wins, RPI, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 losses outside of the top 80. Losses to Houston, NC State, Charleston, Marquette, and Wake Forest. They're just, they're just not very good. Like, we keep going, you know, when LSU, what? This is just what they are. You know, they are actually, when earlier we were talking about, you know, that UConn Andre Drummond team, and like you kept waiting for it to click and it never did. That's what this is. This is a team that you look at the individual talent, mm-hmm. you go, man, if they ever get it going, but they ain't going to get it going. Like,
The problem is that the pieces don't really fit together.
Right.
Like, they're two best players, and I've said this from the start of the season. They don't fit together at all because Ben Simmons and Tim Quarterman both need the ball and neither of them can shoot. And you throw that with a coach who I don't think that it's a secret that Johnny Jones isn't a guy who gets the most out of his teams. That's kind of a problem, I think. And it's not really a surprise.
Well, the other thing is like, and to circle back around the Simmons, like it's an academic issue, right? Like,
that's the most ironic thing ever.
Here's the thing. Like, at what point do we need to have not us three, but just people in general, like have a larger conversation about why wouldn't it be an academic issue? Like, why would Ben Simmons give care a bit about college?
And why do I care if he has an academic issue? Why does the NCAA care if he has an academic issue?
Well, it's just like Derrick Rose had Derrick Rose had an academic issue. You know why? Because we set up a system that, and I know it doesn't force anybody into anything. I don't want to have that argument, but like, come on. It basically forces these kids into college, kids that have no business being in college. Ben Simmons shouldn't be in college any more than I should be in the NBA, you know? And like Ben Simmons, he doesn't belong in college. And Derrick Rose never belonged in college.
He wants to go to college. He can go get his degree at 35 after his knees and back are gone from playing an 82-game schedule in the NBA.
So, like just think about this in practical. First off, think about how many kids go to college who actually like need college and like blow it off, like flunk out of school, like half my friends, right? So, so there's that. But then think about if there was something somebody said, okay, we're going to need you to go do this for the next 8 months, but you are never going to use it. It ain't like it is never going to have any impact on your life. You're not taking English 1 so that you can take English 3 as a sophomore. You know, like it really, you're never going to graduate college unless you just decide you want to for some weird reason. Like, and by the way, you're going to make $150 million. Like this literature class is going to have zero. You don't need it to get to something else, and you'll never use it again. Now, hey, here's your books. Of course you have an academic issue. Like, I barely went to college. Like, I mean, went to class and studied and stuff, and I needed to. Like, I didn't have, I wasn't 6'9". I wasn't 5'9". I'm always amazed when those kids do, like, go to school. Not that, and by the way, I'm not operating under the assumption that they do. I mean, they're mostly online classes and stuff like that. Like, that's the next, like, Bryant Gumbel Inside Sports. Like, you know, how many of these kids are actually like stepping into a classroom like we all stepped into classrooms? Like, it ain't what you think it is. It's mostly online classes. And so, but like why would Ben Simmons do any work? Like, that's what I'm amazed by. I'm not amazed that Ben Simmons has an academic issue. I'm amazed that Jamal Murray doesn't.
Yeah. Especially when you consider, like, Simmons is going to drop out of his, you know, spring semester anyway.
That's where the APR gets, and that's why I hate the APR, because it runs counter to, like, common sense. Like, the idea that Carl Anthony Towns had to actually, like, finish some online courses.
It's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. I mean, it is so ridiculous. The idea that John Calipari's program can be penalized if Carl Anthony Towns doesn't go to school through the end of May or beginning of May or whatever is just asinine. And yet they have the system set up to where he needs to. And, like, that's one of the things Cal talks to those guys about. He's like, listen, you can use me and use us to get wherever you're trying to get, but I just need you to fit. And so what they do is they move to L.A., train, and then, like, file some papers, like, email some stuff in. You know, it's not like they're going to real school. But still, the idea that they even have to do that is ridiculous. Like, Carl mm-hmm. Anthony Towns is training to be the number one pick in the draft, and he's got to, like, sit down for 2 hours and do an English paper? Like, what are we talking about? So it's just – I sort of chuckled when I saw Ben Simmons have an academic issue. Oh, yeah.
And by the way, like, if we're talking about him having an academic issue that has him sit for the first 5 minutes of the game.
Yeah, what does that even mean?
It's probably him just, like, he does have to go to a class. Like, he has to walk into a class and, like, someone, you know, takes his attendance and the coach catches up on the attendance from the teacher. He probably just, like, missed a class or something. Like, that would be what my guess is. That's total speculation. Like, I don't know what happened, but that's probably what the issue was, like something like that. It's just so ridiculous.
No, the whole thing.
Like, you have to make him sit in class and, you know, like, just the fact that he has to pretend to pay attention.
Just stop there. It is ridiculous that Ben Simmons is in a college class. Like, that's the long and short of it. Like, the idea that Ben Simmons is sitting in a class alongside, like, some, like, normal human being is just kind of ridiculous. And that's why.
Like, and let me also say this, too. And it was even more ridiculous for Johnny Jones to bench him for such an issue.
Oh, yeah, right. Like
if that's what it was.
Right. Well, it's funny.
You just took your guy out of the game. Like, I don't know if that's what affected him necessarily, but clearly didn't come in and play as hard as he should have.
Well, it's funny. Like, I had talked to Mark Gasol about this before. And, like Mark went, what's up, Penny? Mark went to school in the United States, of course, but like, if you talk to any of those guys who are from Europe or have European roots, they think it's so insane that the elite college basketball players, like, go to college. Like, why would you take Carl Anthony Towns and put him in college?
Well, literally, this doesn't exist anywhere else in the world, but we do.
No, that's the other thing. Like, if you go literally anywhere else in the world and try to look at how they handle their elite soccer prospects, elite cricket, whatever it is, it doesn't even matter, anything.
Let's break down some elite cricket
prospects. Yeah, I don't know who they are, but I do know, like, for soccer, like, the idea that Ronaldo would end up doing a semester at some university is just ridiculous, right? Can you imagine, like, if Messi had to go to school for a year? what are we even talking about?
So, trying to picture, like, Messi, like, suiting up for UCLA right now.
It's just so, like, backward. It's like, first off, it's like, it's just, it flies in the face of, like, everything an institution of higher learning is supposed to be. But beyond that, it's not a massive waste of time. This is where we sort of get twisted, because, like, Kevin Durant probably made $60 million from going to college and like becoming a star in college. Like he immediately gets this Nike deal. So it's not a waste of time for these guys, like for these, I don't, but like, it's not the, if you could blow it, I guess this is the way I would say it. If you could blow it all up and start a new system, we would never tie what are essentially
it
minor.
It wouldn't be the system.
No, this isn't. If we just said, hey, we're going to, everything's blown up. We're going to start from scratch. What's the best way to do this? We'd never say, we need to have our universities have basketball teams and then let's send our best prospects to play for these universities, make them amateurs and like, you know, turn in papers for a year before they, you know, sign $50 million contracts. Like it's just, the whole thing's ridiculous. Yeah. Let's move on.
Lionel Messi, I just want to point out, played his first game for Barcelona, like the best team in the world when he was 17 years old.
Right. I mean, it's just insane. The whole thing's crazy, right? So, yeah.
What else do you want to hit on?
Well, this, Norlander, I saw you tweet over the weekend, I guess it was, that you don't think most people realize how comfortably Texas Tech is in the NCAA tournament right now. I've actually had them ranked for a little while now because, like, when you look at their resume, it's like, wow. Like, they got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 top 50 wins. Six top 50 wins, including wins over Oklahoma and Iowa State, and only 2 losses outside of the top 30. Like, and some of that, these numbers are a little rigged in favor of the Big 12 teams because it's hard to take bad losses in the Big 12 because every loss is a good loss. But still, 6 top 50 wins and no losses outside the top 30. Like, Tubby, and I'm shocked by this, honestly. I did not think he would be. That job is a hard job. Hard job.
Yes.
And he's got them going. Like, dude, Bob Knight might be the best pure basketball coach ever. I don't want to debate this, but, like, just play along. And, like, he got it going a little bit, but it's at some point he's just getting his brains beat in by big, you know, Kansas, Texas, and Oklahoma State and whatever. This is a hard job. And Tubby's got – this is a good team. He's got a good team.
Listen, he's done a great job. Texas Tech is going to make the tournament barring a collapse for the first time since Knight was there. That was 07. They've since run through Bob Knight's son, Pat. Billy Gillespie had a cup of coffee. Chris Walker took over, and then Tubby's been there. This is now year number 3, and he won 27 games total the past 2 seasons. They're almost certainly going to cross the 20-win plateau this season. They've got Texas Tech's going to be interesting because they've got a home game against TCU on Tuesday. They should win, and they close out the season home game against Kansas State. Win those because you got 2 toughies at Kansas, at West Virginia. I still think if they go 2-2 there and win a Big 12 tournament game, they're going to be in. They had this weird dip. And I understand why they're totally off the radar because they started their Big 12 season with a win over Texas, and then they went on to lose, 8 of their next 9 games. But since then, Iowa State, Baylor, Oklahoma, they got a really critical, sneaky win on Saturday, which is why I sent that tweet out over Oklahoma State. That's just, you know, it's a road game. There's just no guarantee you're going to win it.
But Kansas lost it. There?
Absolutely, Kansas lost there. So Tech is just a team that, like, I think Palm's got him as like an 8 seed right now because just the quality of their wins, and, you know, even like the non-league wasn't amazing, but they didn't get tripped up against any bad teams. The only team they lost to was Utah, which is, you know, on pace for a really, really solid seed at this point. So that's one team that's solidly in the field. I did want to quickly give
hold on 1 second. Utah's another team that I don't think people realize has got a resume as good as they
Utah
do.
Is ridiculous.
7 top 50 RPI wins, only 1 loss outside of the top 50, only 1 home loss. Like I think that I think they're unranked right now. They are unranked right now.
They're going to be ranked this week.
Well, I've had them ranked for a few days. Like if you look at their resume, and people ask me all the time, why do you use the RPI? Because the NCAA tournament uses the RPI. That's why. But the way the NCAA tournament selection committee is going to view them is way more favorably than I think the casual college basketball fan is viewing them right now.
Yeah,
not casually, not positively, I guess is the word I was looking for.
In this year of like crazy Pac-12 upsets where everyone thinks that like, oh yeah, if you're on the road in the Pac-12, you're just going to lose.
Right.
Like we saw Oregon do that last week, for instance. Utah's 5-4 on the road, has 3 home games to finish out their season, and they're only a game behind who is leading the Pac-12, Oregon and Arizona.
Arizona, yeah.
So there's like a very good chance they're going to win the Pac-12.
Yeah, yeah.
They would have a good shot at, I think a 3 seed is Utah's ceiling. And they're the only Pac-12 team that has 2 road weekend sweeps. They went to Washington, swept those schools. Now they're coming off a sweep of the L.A. schools overall. USC is still in good standing in regard to the tournament, but it keeps tripping itself up. It's lost 3 of its past 4. got a win that it needed to have, and they won somewhat convincingly over Colorado earlier in the week. But I don't know if I can quite trust USC. I did real quick here, GP, because I mentioned before we started recording. I just want to give notice on Wisconsin and Seton Hall, sure, just because they were in – like, I don't think – I don't know if Palm's got Seton Hall in or not. I don't think I'd put him in at this point. But they played, like, this really tricky game at St. John's where if you lose it, it's just such a hard thing to overcome. They beat St. John's, and they almost had a freaking fight afterward on the floor. This is becoming a thing. Like, like three near fights or actual fights after handshake lines in games this season. Seton Hall is just one to keep an eye on within the Big East because it's the league is flirting with 5-6 bids overall, maybe 7 if things broke like super right, but I think that's even too much to ask. Seton Hall has beaten Wichita State, which can't lose again until the Valley title game, in my opinion. Now it has two opportunities at home against Providence and Xavier. So huge opportunities coming for Seton Hall. They're probably way off everyone's radar, but they're right there. Wisconsin's the other team. Flirted with an awful home loss against Illinois on Sunday. They came back. They had a 17-0 run. They got it. Wisconsin is super weird. Okay, they're 17-10. They had the Bo Ryan retirement. Sure. Doesn't matter because Bo Ryan – it doesn't matter that Bo Ryan was a coach when they opened the season with the loss to Western Illinois. They lost to Georgetown. Georgetown is killing people stock by the week. Georgetown used to be good. Now they're just hideous. They might not even make the NIT. They're the second most disappointing team in the sport to Vanderbilt, in my opinion, this season. Wisconsin also has a loss to Milwaukee. It has a home loss to Marquette, which isn't going to look that good. And it has a road loss against Northwestern, which isn't the worst, but Northwestern's not having a great year. That said, it's only lost once in the past month, okay? And that was at Michigan State. So it's building a case. I don't think Wisconsin should be in the tournament yet. It does have tremendous opportunities upcoming at Iowa, then home to Michigan, got to win at Minnesota, even though Maryland couldn't do it, and at Purdue. If it goes, it has those two, and then its first Big Ten tournament game. If it goes 3-2 in any combination of those games, I believe that it will get into the tournament. What are your thoughts?
If you were Wisconsin, wouldn't you be trying to make the case? I don't even know if you can make this case. It's such a rare and perhaps unprecedented situation. But wouldn't you be saying, hey, you know how you judge a team based on if they get a mid-year transfer eligible and it changes the team?
Yeah.
We got a different coach.
They'll make that case, probably.
Oh, sure. But, like, the problem is, becomes, like, you take a step back and you go, hold on. You're trying to say Bo Ryan was the issue with your team?
Exactly. which doesn't work.
Well, the other problem is, too, that you're taking away VCU and Syracuse wins.
Yeah, you're right.
As well, if you do that. So, right. I mean, yeah, that probably helps because it takes away Western Illinois, Milwaukee, Marquette losses. But, like, at a point, you still need a certain amount of wins. I'd probably put Wisconsin in at this point just because I think they're playing that well.
I think they're one of the best, better teams in the country now.
Yeah, I think that they're one of the 70 best teams in the country. And remember, it's a soft bubble because of the two schools that are not eligible for the NCAA tournament in Louisville and SMU. I think they should be in. The team I want to talk about is the good old alma mater, Ohio State, sitting at 10-5 in the Big Ten. I mean, it's not really that fascinating. They're really not even on the bubble right now because, their wins in the Big Ten this year are over. Minnesota, Illinois, Northwestern, Rutgers, Penn State, Illinois, Northwestern, Rutgers, Michigan, and Nebraska.
They just need two more games against Rutgers. They're going to be fine.
Yeah, but here's the thing. They have Michigan State, Iowa, Michigan State to finish their schedule. Right. Two of those games at home, if they can win two of those three, I think it might be hard to keep them out at 12-6. With wins over Kentucky, Michigan State, and Iowa.
And that's true. Rothstein did tweet that, and listen, it's different this year, but he tweeted that no, and the committee, by the way, does not consider this, doesn't give a damn about it. He said no Big Ten team has ever won 11 games in conference and not gotten a bid. There are sometimes these weird patterns.
Right.
That's not why no Big Ten team's ever not gotten a bid. It's because those 11 wins combined with a non-conference led up to getting a bid. Ohio State's just built, and this is what uneven conference schedules will give you. Ohio State's got to win at least two of those three and a Big Ten tournament game to start to have a case. But you know what? I'll give them credit because Parrish was there when Ohio State beat Kentucky, and that was – we covered it thoroughly on the podcast.
Shocking.
One of the most random games I think I've ever witnessed in person, okay?
How you lose to Memphis and beat Kentucky in the same – like. Decade, but especially in the same,
the same decade.
But it like it,
they dropped three straight games.
That was
UT Arlington, Louisiana Tech, Memphis.
They lost on a neutral court to Memphis and beat Kentucky inside of 3 weeks, and like didn't just beat Kentucky, like they beat Kentucky's brains in.
Yes, absolutely. It was so weird. if it gets three wins in any sort of way, probably going to have a case there. Wisconsin's sitting much better than Ohio State right now, but they could get really interesting in a hurry. They get the benefit of their next two games being at home, but they're also playing two teams that are playing for one seeds in Michigan State and Iowa. So it's about to get really intriguing with the Buckeyes.
Listen, if they can somehow get two of those three, and certainly three of three, then they're back in play. But like as we're talking right now, I'm just pulled up the resume. They got one top 50 win.
Yeah, no, they're not on the bubble yet, but they're like in a position where I don't think they control their own destiny necessarily. But with these two home games coming up that are legitimate resume builders, potentially, it's a nice situation to be in, given that they were, what, 2-4 and 4-5?
How about this?
Through like December 12th?
I didn't think on February 21st we'd be talking about Ohio State maybe putting themselves in position to make the NCAA tournament. But, yeah, I mean, they could.
Shout out to David Leidy.
Shout out to David Leidy.
David Leidy is a top five human that has played college basketball.
They could add three top 25 wins and then, you know, in their next three games. That's even before the Big Ten tournament. I will say that, you know, talking about 12 conference wins or top three finish, I never, ever, ever look at the conference standings and never, ever, ever look at conference wins. So, like, I got some Arizona fans, like, really on me. Like, hey, Arizona's in first place in the Pac-12. How do you have them ahead of Utah? Utah undeniably has a better resume than Arizona right now.
Yeah.
I don't know that Utah's better, but in terms of, like, wins and losses relative to the RPI, like, Arizona has two top 50 wins. Utah has seven. Arizona has one loss outside of the top 50. I think Utah has two. Like, Utah is in second place in the, or maybe even third place in the Pac-12, but they've got the best resume in the Pac-12 right now. I don't even think it's close. And so I don't pay that much attention to the league standings, but I know they matter to some degree. Anything else, or is it time to go?
I think it might be time to go.
Feels like it's time to go.
It's been interesting.
I bet you no college basketball podcast in history has covered the subjects we've covered today.
Nope.
Is that fair?
This is why the people tune in.
And let me be clear, I hope no other college basketball podcast in history ever covers these topics again. Sincerely, thank you for bearing with me at the top, listening, and we'll call it a therapy session. Remember, you can subscribe to the Island College Basketball Podcast on iTunes. That is the quickest way to get the latest episodes, and we'll talk to you again later on this week. Take care.